Well, we appreciate your input. At this time, we're going to open the meeting up to for the opportunity for the public to make comments. And I have before me a couple of sheets here. What I'm going to ask you to do is to try to keep your comments brief and to the point of the changes that we're discussing. Okay, we don't want to open this up to a whole new debate because we've already been through that through the public hearing. And what I'm going to do is I'll call you up to the front table, introduce yourself, and then... Okay, the first person I'd like to recognize is Hendrik Jindos from Brooklyn.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I am Hendrik Jindos of Brooklyn, Maine. An awful lot of work has gone into this. I appreciate that. I'm not sure today whether I'm Hendrik Jindos or Don Quixote or Don Corleone. Last Friday came the Chapter 200 rules and the 85-page basis statement. And that's the basis statement is what I'm responding to here today. Due diligence, look in my hand. I have been through it three times since the Friday afternoon. We find ourselves in very much the same position, you members of the board and me, a public advocate. You are unpaid volunteers. That's the same status I enjoy. Your charge is to provide informed, independent, and timely decisions respecting interpretation, administration, enforcement of laws pertaining to environmental protection, and to provide for credible, fair, and responsible public participation in department decisions. I try to live up to those same obligations in my public advocacy. But how can you do your job, and I do mine, if we can't trust the materials in front of us? That's a very heavy statement. Well, let me repeat it. If we can't trust the materials in front of us. Today's proceedings come under the provisions of the Maine Administrative Procedure Act. The board is preparing to adopt the written statement explaining the policy basis for the rule. You're obliged to identify the names of the persons and organizations submitting comments and providing summaries. The agency's asked to address the comments and concerns, state its rationale for either adopting or failing to adopt proposed changes or drawing findings and recommendations that may differ from those advanced. In preparing the statement, the agency may synthesize similar comments and concerns, but it must accurately reflect the meaning and intent of the submissions. Now, you all know that, but there may be people in the audience who don't appreciate the specifics of those obligations which you all are operating under. You've given us a chance to address you orally, but instructions were clear that nothing written would be accepted without the permission of the chair. Consider, though, these nine categories of shortcomings that I found. I'm not going to give you the documentation, although I have it. The biggest singular and overarching flaw in the basis statement is that it completely sidesteps the highest priority shortcoming of the rules, namely that good rules cannot be written on a deeply flawed statute. You have explicit authority to address that shortcoming in whatever detail you wish, but so far you've been silent about its exercise. That can only be seen as a major omission. Second category, it's the kind of the other end of the significance scale. Two other submitters are identified as the contributors of points I know I presented to the board. I looked at their submissions. They did not say the same thing I did. Third category. In between shortcomings of a vastly different scale are many others. I've had to do this kind of analytic work that MAPA requires over and over again in my professional life. Nonetheless, there are six other kinds of basis flaws that should not have occurred. For example, at one key point in the basis statement, a point advanced by the submitter was misstated, incorporated That distortion into the heading for that section climbs all over the point that wasn't made and ignores the core concern that was raised. Fourth category. The basis statement presents three numbered sections sprinkled widely throughout the title, support for revisions. Tell me when I'm 50 seconds short and I'll jump through this listing. This approach of identifying support for revisions gives the impression, mistaken impression, that there were in fact more comments about approbation than actually existed. Fifth, other repetitive sections within the basis could have been combined and addressed in concert, as well as simplifying the process of citizen or legislative oversight. That's an editor's comment, not crucial. Over and over again, though, sixth, the rationale for not making requested changes was either explicitly or implicitly, we have the statute and that's what we're sticking with come hell or high water. Seventh, in too many specific instances, the agency responses are simply unresponsive to the points advanced, either ignoring the issue or advancing arguments that are off point or obfuscatory, if that's a word, or presenting analysis that is contradictory. Eighth, in at least two instances, promised changes in the rules failed to make it into the new draft, although I know there's notice that there's a whole new one out. And a third point that was raised was ignored with the result that the technical error identified still remained in the latest draft, the latest one being the one I downloaded on December 30th. Finally, there are instances of material in the basis statement that simply don't belong in a basis statement because they don't pertain to the rules per se and or are otherwise inappropriate. I'm done categorizing what I found. My summary conclusion, after spending four solid days on those documents, is that the basis statement before you has been insufficiently vetted for you to act on it today. Chairman Parker, my remarks have been abbreviated. I categorized nine types of flaws. Color-coded documentary detail illustrating each of those nine categories is prepared and available. Should you ask me for it, I have a copy of the same and would be pleased to leave it with you. And I should add that anyone behind me or at the table who wants to receive a copy, just write your email on a piece of paper and hand it to me before we all leave, and I will see to it that you get it in 24 hours. Would you like to have what I've prepared?
Thank you, Mr. Giddens. Any questions? I see no, but thank you.
Would you like to have what I brought?
Not at this time, but they can give you the email address if they want it.
Now here comes the Don Corleone part. Are you really certain that you don't want to receive the due diligence that I, as a public citizen, have undertaken to do the homework necessary to appear before you with any kind of sensibility today?
Board consensus?
That's up to you, sir, according to the rules.
I'd say at this time, no. Thank you.
The die is cast. Thank you very much. However, that doesn't apply to all of you. I will take the email requests.
Lou Kingsbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Lou Kingsbury. I live in Bidston, Maine. As in three times in the past, I'm here for the third time on these rules, and I will limit my comments to the basis statement as it applies to the wet waste units. I'd like to quote from the wet waste unit response. These activities may include removing the reactive rock from the mine waste unit and permanently placing the material back in the pit or underground workings for closure. One company, Akia Resources, has proposed a similar closure plan for its proposed Back 40 project in Stevenson, Michigan. Now, that's never been done before. All right? The containment structures portion of subchapter 5, page 64H of the proposed rules outlines the construction of the containment structures of these wet mine waste units. These rules are the same as the McKay School of Mines containment structure designs for permanent perpetual care waste units. They have the same requirements. There is no limit on their size in these rules. It makes it sound like they're a storage unit in a storage facility, like we put our furniture in. Sometimes these wet mine waste units can be hundreds and perhaps thousands of acres in size. If we were mining a Bald Mountain with a 30 million ton ore deposit, and we're taking out the 50% of that deposit that is sulfur and putting them in wet mine waste units, it would be in the thousands of acres in size. It is hard to conceive that you would be able to create these structures, put waste in them for upwards of 30 years, and then think that you are going to dewater them, empty them, and put them elsewhere. And again, keep in mind, this has never been done before. We asked the ENR to go look at an area and find us one that this had been done before, and I think that state geologist Mr. Marvini went and looked, and he reported back on tailings ponds, couldn't find one of those that had been done, but he'd never addressed the issue of whether a wet mine waste unit had been done successfully. These are designed to be permanent structures. These are not designed with the idea that they will be remediated and that large rock will be put elsewhere. The public will not be happy until this waste is kept in a dry environment. In a dry environment, we do not run the risk of a dam, an earthen dam, which is allowed as part of the construction of these wet mine waste units, failure in an area where we see 50 inches or better of rain statewide as an average. And sometimes, as you may know, and especially recently, we see large rain events which will overload these units just like they have elsewhere in the country, and they will fail over time. Now, I think the rules originally said that came out of the latest go-around on this said that they would be remediated at the mine closure. Now, I think the latest set of rules, if I read it right, allows 15 years after mine closure. A lot can happen in those 15 years. Companies can go belly up. Especially ones that are just paper companies disassociated with the parent company that is actually funding it. And the taxpayer will be stuck with perpetual treatment of these in an environment where these storage units were designed for perpetual storage. So it's unacceptable. I think, Professor Eastler, you'll recall a discussion we had the last time these rules were around there. I told you that the public would not accept these. These rules got defeated 3-1 in the House. I don't expect any different change until wet storage goes away and we have dry storage.
Thank you. Any questions?
One last thing I just want to get on the table.
Okay.
Seeing there are very few public commenters today, I took the liberty of wanting to bring one other topic up. I hope that many of you saw either in the Washington Post or in the Press Herald, the story about the Berkeley pit, the 700-acre Berkeley pit out in Montana. It's a Superfund site, a flooded-out copper mine pit, open pit, where 10,000 geese were killed when they landed in the pit. I don't want that. I don't want that happening here in May. If any of you would like to read it, I can provide it, or you can Google it on site. It's easy to find. But these wet mine waste units, or flooded out pits, whichever way you want to call it, are very dangerous things. And they are potentially perpetually as a trap. So that's it.
Any questions? Thank you. Next will be Bruce Tax. I'd like to caution those who are testifying to keep their comments relating to stuff that's been involved in the rulemaking and any changes that are proposed. I don't want any new information provided, just we're reviewing what's already been in the record, plus the comments from today. So the floor is yours, Mr. Tax.
Chairman Parker, members of the board, Commissioner Mercer, good morning. I'm Bruce Taylor from the town of Sweden. My comments will be in regard to the basis statement and also to the proposed changes in Chapter 200 as of January 5th of this year. So while I will not address the flaws in the Metallic Mining Act, or I will not address what appears to be a major substantive error in the proposed rule that was not so noted, I would like to say one thing about the procedure since it just came up. This errata was not on your website. I haven't had a chance to read it. I don't. So when I talk about anything here, I am ignorant. I think that is, along with the public notice, time and ample time, and also the method of notification, I think this is another procedural error. I'd like to start off by thanking the department for the changes in the rules in the public hearing. Especially since we are still paying for the permitted Callahan Mine Corporation site, both on our tax, federal, state, and tax dollars. Our taxpayers have a great responsibility and liability in the closing of a mine, not only in dollars, but also a liability in the persistence of toxins that can last up to 100 years. I would like to specifically address in the basis statement, number 23, support for revisions. There's a different numbering system, so I don't know if it's your 134 or 30. The numbering system, unfortunately, was very confusing. There it states that two commenters gave support to the Chapter 200 rules. I don't know if there is humor on the part of the Department of Environmental Protection at the cost of taxpayers' dollars, or if it's inattention to detail. One of those commenters, C-103, I think should be definitely struck. I know that person very well. So what you have, according to this statistics, as has been brought out, you now only have one out of the 498 comments that are in support of metallic mining, which comes to 0.2008% of the comments were positive. And since that person was misquoted, I think it is only fair to state why that person was opposed in general, very briefly, to metallic mining, because the technologic advancements in metallic mining in recent times still have harmful human health effects, and they continue. Look at Tar Creek, and look at what happened at Rio Doce or Mount Polley. Particulate matter, again, the reason why I'm concerned about being misconstrued in number 23, because particulate matter is a very extremely toxic. Next to radioactive matter, I think both from work at UC Davis and also from University of Arizona, work with particulate matter generated from mining activities is only worse, or is only radioactive material is worse than that. And again, I was concerned persistently about the persistent and gratuitous mention of public health with throughout this. Public health was mentioned, I think, 17 times, 23 times in November by word count in the November revision. And yet we just, a recent change that the department, although they mentioned public health 23 times, the department now has no expertise in it, and the department and you are going to allow permitting of something very dangerous for which the people who wrote the rules admit they know nothing about, and yet they try to cover it. And finally, what is most troubling again is that, and it was stated, I think, in the September meeting, that the department, and very wisely so, is trying to streamline and minimize case-by-case decisions to have a more mechanized conveyor belt sort of permitting process for the permittee, which is good. But what about the protection of human health? Every time when you look in the rules, every time there is human health, they say, should, to be determined, maybe, can be, i.e. it's not mandated. It's not mandated. Public health, the protection of public health is not mandated. It's up to the whim of the department. And like I say, Mr. Crawford stated that the Department of Protection, Environmental Protection, doesn't know public health, yet they admittedly throughout the document at least 23 times discuss protection of public health and how's that going to happen under these mining rules. And I'd like to say, is that protection? To go to the worst case scenario, several times the worst case scenario is mentioned. And when I hear worst case scenario, I think in medicine, either in the field, in the military or a civilian, I think of a major disaster threatening life, limb, vision, or neurologic status. Also, now being a selectman, I'm getting involved as all the municipalities in the state of Maine and the major industrial sites with the national incident management system, and you need to look at what they consider a worst case scenario. And the department also accepted that in the term worst case scenario. And it now looks like they didn't accept that term in a protective sense. If you go to number 2, financial insurance, page 109 or page 5, the department affirms that it considers a worst case scenario. In fact, the DEP states that it uses a worst case scenario to establish financial assurance coverage requirements. The department proposal is consistent with worst case scenarios employed by researchers in other jurisdictions. And the one example that they use of researchers in other jurisdictions in the basis statement is a 14-year-old study from what this must be the best study they can come up with from the Center for Science and Public Participation, and it's a Greens Creek Mine Financial Assurance Review from June 2003. Here it is. I'm sure you all read it because it was in the basis statement. And the only problem with this worst case scenario, well, one of the major problems with the worst case scenario and the persistent and pervasive thinking of the department is when they don't even mention worst case scenario in this publication. I'm sure you all caught that. And when they didn't mention disaster, they didn't mention incident, they didn't mention health, or didn't mention citizens. What they're concerned about here is remediation costs. Now, remediation is very, very important. I don't doubt that. But is that the worst case scenario? When you think about your children and grandchildren, do you think of remediation or do you think of loss of life, limb, vision, or neurologic damage? And is that protection from the Department of Environmental Protection? Section 9I, 5, Roman numeral 2. The department, under the worst case scenario, they say requires a detailed, and I quote, detailed written cost estimate for worst case scenario. And in the details, they list what they want to hear. What is it? An environmental impact assessment. Does that involve humans? No, unless you are in an archaeological site, unless you are part of archaeology, it doesn't involve it. It involves enclosure and infrastructure, things like that. That's very important, but where is the human health protection in that? And is that protection? To go to Section 17, financial assurance and insurance requirements. There are two things I like to bring out. First of all, it was not addressed, the pollution exclusion for general liability, which they asked. I'm not a lawyer calling up well, I'm not a lawyer, but you need to be very careful. I'm sure the Attorney General can help you on this. Pollution exclusion and general liability insurance has to be specifically mandated because it's not necessarily covered. So if you're talking about insurance and somebody decided to put insurance and general liability sudden and non-sudden in here, so let's make sure what we're talking about. It doesn't necessarily, if there's a pollution exclusion, if there's a pollution exclusion, the courts in the state of Maine basically have two cases that I could find, and it's very inconsistent how it's been determined. So don't think there's any insurance for medical coverage. Although, like it was stated, the Department of Environmental Protection wouldn't know what medical coverage entails anyway, although they say they had it. So again, and the other thing is about financial, with insurance, not assurance, they do talk about the using the GDP deflator as an in for increase of financial insurance, not using the CPI. On average, if GDP financial deflator, which is an inflation measure, goes up about 1% a year. So yes, they are looking at how to, with the financial assurance, not insurance, how to increase the coverage by every year. That's the least amount. And they say they do it to cover equipment. So what are they protecting in financial assurance? You think they're protecting the people? They're protecting equipment. And whose equipment is that? Who's the insured party? That's a very good point. They don't have CPI. And if you use the number to cover health, it's a national health examination by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and there that increases 5%. So if you have over 10 years, you've already lost 50% of your health care coverage. And that brings up the next question, is insurance. And they the insurance coverage for liability, which may not cover medical, is absurdly low. Again, pollution, they're not going to determine who gets the money. Is it going to go to repairing all the multi-million dollar equipment? How much does a remote controlled big cat machine that's going to be working in a pit in Bald Mountain cost? It costs about $3.7 million, even though it's going to be controlled at a control center in Canadians in New Brunswick. It's still going to cost $3.7 million to repair it here in the United States. The sudden accidental coverage is $10 million per occurrence and $20 per aggregate. Come on. Those of you that can carry commercial insurance know for a major disaster, you're barely covered. Sudden, non-sudden insurance, which should cover chronic exposure to pollution, but you better check the pollution exclusion, is 6 and 12. It's going to cover damage, machinery, roads, cleanup, which is all important, but what about protection of the general population? Where is the protection? And when you look at the cost of Mount Polly, when you look at something different, but when you just look at the cost of lead, which is a NAAQS criteria, as you all know, and the number one producer of lead in the United States into the atmosphere is metallic mining. When you look at Flint, which is a little different, the cost of evaluation, not treatment, but the cost of evaluation for lead toxicity, just the evaluation was several thousand dollars per child. What is that protection? And again, I talked about the adjustment. There is no, it mandates a specific amount of insurance with no adjustment. So 10, 20, and 50 years is going to be far less financial coverage. Tailings. Confusion. I think all of you are confused, and I think, unfortunately, the members of the department are confused. Tailings. I called Colorado School of Mines and asked them, what's tailings? What is wet mine unit? The problem is, as Mr. Stebbins said, they're the same. And yet, when you start looking at all the definition changes they play, which I think is a major substantive change in the definitions, I'll get to that later, they're really playing a shell game. So confusing that they don't understand it, and you don't understand the difference between wet mine units and tailings. According, if you want, it is important to note, and I'm sure this can be disputed, but Colorado School of Mines, and then they sent me to tailings.com, and then I called a very nice South African engineer, includes unrecoverable and economic minerals, chemicals, and organics. That is in tailings. Tailings are exceedingly dangerous. For one example of many,
well, two. One, it can have a very low pH, and secondly, it can contain arsenic. And already the state of Maine has problems with arsenic in the well water. It's very soluble. You will have arsenic and other heavy metals in solution in the tailings. So don't think the tailings are safe. And again, I really apologize for this, but it is exceedingly, I think everybody here and everybody there is confused. The difference between, I don't know, they probably said, I wish we never put this in here. Wet mine waste units and tailing impoundments. And when I called up the people who wrote this about worst case scenario, I asked the Center for Public Science, what is a worst case scenario in mining? And you know what they said? Tailing dam failure is a worst case scenario. And they said damage to humans is a worst case scenario, not remediation, which is important, and not making sure that the mining companies get their money back for their expensive equipment. And yet this is what the department used as their example of a worst case scenario. I think there's something wrong here. And then the problem with tailings, the change in definitions, I think you need to look at the change in definitions as a major substantive change between, and I'm not a lawyer, and with your timing of your, I have to apologize because this, I don't think the notice and over 100 pages of documents appeared not on the DEP website under rulemaking, but didn't appear under, hidden in the, obscured in the Bureau of, Board of Environmental Protection until Friday afternoon, and I stayed up last night reading this. But I think that there is a very significant change between the definition of in the use of tailings, the definition of tailings and wet mine unit between 1116 and 1115, and because if you look at wet mine waste unit definition on the 16th, they include mine workings that are either partially or wholly flooded after closure. Suddenly, they put, and I think this, I don't know, is a major substantive change, mine workings that are either partly or wholly flooded after closure are not wet mine waste units. And one of the most crucial concerns about health and safety of mining is wet mine waste units or tailings that I don't see anybody transcribing, but I believe Mr. Stibbins said they're the same. I think that's what he said. And yet you're making a major substantive change. That will affect health. They did a word shell game, trickery of words and not a protection. And is that protection? Finally, air quality. There are comments made on air quality. And Maine is already at great risk for medical problems, with poor medical care, and specifically with heavy metals already. Mercury is a problem in the state of Maine, not only in the water, but also from the power plants in the Midwest. And arsenic in our well water has already been presented. If you are looking, I think there should be continuous emission monitoring system, and also, although it is typically applied to existing plants and NAAQS criteria, it can be applied. There's nothing in the Clean Air Act that prohibits LEER, lowest achievable emission rates, to be applied to the toxic compounds that will be generated by mining coming out of the stacks and in fugitive emissions. And that would include lead, which if you look at the toxic release inventory from the EPA self-reported every year, mining is a leader, but also mercury and arsenic. There should be minimum, every effort should be made to reduce that. Because remember, as was said, I think in the September meeting, one of the board members of the Environmental Protection even said this could happen anywhere in the state. So it's just not going to be mining, theoretically, by these rules, just isn't going to be somewhere out in the boonies in Bald Mountain where some Native Americans are going to be. It could be next to your country club where your children and grandchildren are having an Easter egg hunt. So finally, I would like to say that that the airsheds and watersheds in Maine, in regard to the airsheds and watersheds in Maine, pollution, dilution is not the solution to pollution. There are mandated protections for the permittee throughout this. Public health is mentioned, but there are no specifics. This is you are entering into something exceedingly dangerous, and there will be stringent standards applied, as has been mentioned, but not to protect human health. So I would like to ask a rhetorical question ending. There is the Board of Environmental Protection and the Department of Environmental Protection, but I ask you, where is the protection?
Thank you. Any comments or questions?
Yeah, just one comment, and that is, just as we deal in industry with OSHA for occupational safety and health, in mining, the federal MSHA, mining safety and health, takes over the where the state may not necessarily be involved, because there are federal mining safety and health issues. I can't expound on them now. I hope you've looked into that as well to see whether some of the answers you're asking to get will be given to you or not by MSHA, because that's there, and that's to watch out what's going on, not just for the machinery. They don't do the machinery necessarily. They are part of their name is health. So mining safety and health.
I believe that applies to personnel and visitors within the mining site. It's covered by what this is covered. And, you know, I guess it's fair. I don't want to take your time. I guess it's fair play to bring up the SIP, the state the SIP, the state plan, because that was also given to me in one of my responses. And that really comes under, and I'm talking about is the Clean Air Act. I don't think the Mining Safety Act at least covers non-personnel who aren't in the mining area or visitors. So although there are some very good ideas, and some of those ideas, actually I was prepared for this, I should have been prepared for this. If you look at all the protective equipment that they have, which if you just happen to be next door to it and you're not in the mining area and there's a fugitive admission, you don't have the protective equipment that the respirator and the Kevlar suits provide. So I think you're right. The only problem is that degree of safety should be given to the public, and these rules do not do it.
Any further comments, questions?
Great. Thank you.
Next to speak will be Doug Bowen.
I want to follow up a little bit with what Bruce Taylor said. As Bruce briefly mentioned, this meeting was announced on Friday afternoon before a 3-day holiday weekend. We were given 2 business days to digest this, the 90-page statement, some other material. The weather was bad much of the period between the weekend and now, and many of the people here, I suspect, work regular hours. I imagine that many people couldn't make it for the same reason. 4 days is really unreasonable. I want to go to the Maine revised statutes, Title I, General Provisions, Chapter 13, Public Records and Proceedings, Subchapter 1, Freedom of Access, and 406, Public Notice. Public notice shall be given for all public proceedings as defined in Section 402, if these proceedings are a meeting of a body or agency consisting of 3 or more people. This notice shall be given in ample time to allow public attendance and shall be disseminated in a manner reasonably calculated to notify the general public in the jurisdiction served by the body. I already mentioned in terms of ample time. I don't think it was ample at all. And I think most people would agree. People were used to using the Department of Environmental website for gaining information about these kinds of gatherings. Now, most recently, it was the Board of Environmental Protection's website that it was on. And it was on in a what people found to be a very obscure manner at the bottom of the page of agenda items. I conclude that the timing of this meeting fails to adhere to the public notice requirement. And I think it has had an effect on attendance by the public. This is ultimately all about the public. When you get beyond the geologists and the lawmakers and all this and that, it's about us. I want to just add something very quick to an item you mentioned a few minutes ago in comparing mining under bodies of water. When you said that that's what was done with salt mines under Detroit, upstate New York, under cities, out in the water, Lake Erie, whatever. I think that it's not quite right to do a comparison like that. Salt mines do not contain toxic material. No material from a salt mine arrives on the surface. Salt mines are located between impermeable beds of limestone, dolostone, etc. In fact, they're dry. In fact, they're so dry that the old mines are routinely used to store vast amounts of material. I think we really have to be careful here about making comparisons that, even without meaning to, can be disingenuous, can be misleading. And I will leave at this point, except to also say, and I think someone else is going to bring it up, is that by the same token, it is not reasonable to compare the Bald Mountain site with the Eagle Mine site. There are vast differences, which I think someone else will explain. Any feedback on the issue about the timing of this meeting?
Any comment? Thank you.
I gather that there's no evidence of concern here, that the timing was correct and proper.
You can present to the board, but don't question the board. If you have a question or comment, make it. Other than that, thank you.
Okay. I guess we leave it at that.
Dennis Shinoy.
Thank you for holding this hearing. As with many in this room, it's taken me some effort to be able to come to speak to you in person today. So even if the following scenario seems at first a tad off topic, I hope you'll please indulge me for the sake of the perspective it might afford. My comments are brief. Imagine that 3 years ago, nuclear waste management lobbyists write a bill hastily presented at the very end of a legislative session, a bill whose text is revealed less than 24 hours prior to a scheduled public hearing. The law authorizes the creation of interim nuclear waste storage facilities in Maine. It passes with the assistance of a $300,000 lobbying blitz coordinated by industry lobbyists. The ostensible rationale is that creating such nuclear waste repositories will provide jobs for Mainers in dire need of employment, and that modern technology now makes nuclear storage safe. Now, suppose that the bill mandates the DEP to write regulations streamlining the permitting process for interim storage of nuclear waste in Maine. since no such regulations exist that comport with the bill's intent, having its purview restricted to how, not whether, to implement such a directive, the DEP conscientiously goes about trying to answer pertinent, specific questions. Questions such as, should truck, rail, or both transport the waste? How close to population centers should transport be allowed? How close to watersheds should be permissible? What specifications need waste canisters have to withstand unanticipated events such as train accidents and associated fires?
Excuse me, Mr. Chinoy, we're not here on a debate over the Nuclear Waste Disposal. We're reacting to a mandate by the legislature to review these rules.
I understand.
But the public comment today relates to the rules that are before you, any changes proposed to them, and we'd accept any comments you have regarding those. So please get to your point.
Okay. I have about 2 minutes, and the reason I think this is pertinent is because a cardinal flaw in the rules is precisely a lack of even a slightly more aerial view about what these rules should do and can't do. So, mandated public hearings on the rules ensue, informed citizens critique waste canister specifications, water quality monitoring regimens, radiation exposure estimates, etc. But despite the admission, and this is where we're getting closer to the bone here, the public comments stick to the detailed chapter and verse of the proposed rules. Overwhelmingly, the testimony features Mainers by margins of 30 to 1 or more, asserting that nuclear waste in Maine might be a really bad idea, that the framers of the law mandating these derivative rules never seriously considered damage to Maine's environment, economy, public health might be, that they took at face value. Industry claims that storage would provide hundreds of good-paying jobs, that what we really need is a law that asks how to dispassionately consider both the risks and benefits of interim waste storage rather than a law whose primary purpose is to streamline the permitting process for companies intent on doing so. Of course, we're not talking about that. We're talking about mining here. A different headline, but the same bind. We're talking and working at cross purposes. Bureau and department members, for their part, diligently adhere to their circumscribed mandate. Testifiers, some still patient, others increasingly exasperated now at year three, feel that the same diligence so narrowly focused translates to institutional tunnel vision. The only way out of our groundhog scenario is for the legislature to finally conclude that we need a new legislative start. You can't make them do that, but you can surely help. Your options include, most radically, the disapprove the rules that staff has spent countless hours working on. That would be a stunning message to the legislature. In my view, this verdict is the most appropriate and enlightened, not only because we're missing the forest for the trees, but also because some of the trees themselves remain rotten. But for you to do so would be to reject all the good faith work your DEP colleagues have invested. Even a split vote, rather than the unanimous one, would send a potent message, but I appreciate why you would think that's simply not possible. So please consider option two. Preface your recommendation to the legislature with a clear and unambiguous statement. Make plain that despite your approval of these mining regulations, if you approve them, you have listened to voluminous public testimony asserting the need not for yet another revision of now twice rejected rules, but for new mining legislation, and that you yourselves believe, as our state's environmental stewards, that after 3 years of this process, new law, not rehashed regulations, is better public policy for Maine. You would be doing us a great public service. Thank you, and thank you for your patience.
Thank you for your comments. Questions? Well, we appreciate it. Betsy Bishop Terrell.
My name is Betsy Bishop Terrell. I own camps on Carpon. My family's been on Carpon since 1902. Carpon is about 2 miles from Bald Mountain. I'm concerned that the proposed rules do not protect Maine. I have actively watched the Maine mining revision process since the beginning. I wrote letters and spoke at previous public hearings to testify against these flawed rules. Over this period of time, I have thankfully witnessed overwhelming opposition to the flawed revisions, and unfortunately witnessed the mining industry's representatives advise and amend these rules with only their needs in mind and not the long-term effects that would have on the environment. These revised proposed rules still cater to the metallic mineral mining industry. Maine's natural resources are what draws people to live, work, and visit in this great state. Its diverse habitats, clean water, are essential to Maine's fish and wildlife and the people who make their living from it. The health of our next generation depends on sustainable natural resources and clean environment. Maine depends on the tourists that come to visit Maine the way life should be. It is your duty to develop these rules that will protect Maine's environment and taxpayers from unnecessary tax burdens from mining. With the proposed revisions, mining would still be allowed on the public lands under the lakes, rivers, and floodplains, coastal waters of Maine. This is not what taxpayers want. As I understand these revised rules, it would allow the use of waste ponds for waste disposal. This would be a disaster waiting to happen. The taxpayers are not protected from the likelihood of an environmental catastrophe because the revised rules do not have adequate financial assurance. If you remember only one thing, you must be accountable for your actions and your conscience. It's not too late to start over and prevent these flawed rules from becoming law and harming our environment. Now is the time to protect the environment. I also brought some pictures with my statement that I'd like you to see. If you're getting to look at them, I have them here.
We're not accepting.
So I can show them from across the room. This is a picture of Moose Pond. It's between Bald Mountain and Carpon. I consider it a sacred area surrounded by old growth cedar. And I have a picture of that old growth cedar. My husband and I, with our arms fully around and just barely touching each other, you can see that it's a huge tree. And it's not just one huge tree, it's a grove of these trees that should be protected. And we want to protect the beauty of the area. So Bald Mountain in the backdrop with Bishop Mountain in the front. Beautiful view looking from a cabin across the lake from our cabin. And this is important to protect our natural beauty, wildlife, and fisheries in Maine. Here's a picture, I hope you can see this one, of Fish River Falls. This is during the summer. This is the beginning of the Fish River chain. And this picture here represents what would it be like in the spring when the waters are melting and the waters are rushing. A little boastful picture. Here's a picture of good fishing at Carpon, and the area is known for good fishing and what it takes to have that type of fish live in a lake like that, natural landlocked salmon. So we want to protect the waters of Maine. It's a picture of a bald eagle. This is an immature bald eagle. It kind of states that it's a good habitat for eagles to breed. Of course, we want to protect our loons and the moose and the wildlife. And I don't know if you can see this picture here, but this is a picture of rain running right off the roof of the camp. So a rainy day at Carpon. Wet soils are my concern. So as you can see, there's a lot of things to protect here. So I ask you, with these rules, will the spring water my family drinks and the visitors drink, will the fish we eat and the air we breathe be safe with these rules? I'm not convinced of this. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Comments, questions?
Thank you.
Next would be Craig Terrell.
James, Cynthia, thank you for seeing me again. We've all been through a lot. As you know, most of us have a great distance to drive to be here, and we're also not paid. So it's been a long, involved process. I've been here since the beginning. I witnessed 1853 in its inception. Unfortunately, during that period, some major changes were made in 1853, allowing the groundwater contamination in the mining area that wasn't allowed previously. And this was unvetted. We never got a chance to comment on it. I sat with my lips closed, and I trembled at the thought that we could possibly pass something like this, and it did. And it passed at the last minute. And then it was kind of a slip in on December 23rd when nobody else is around, everybody's on vacation, and the motion passed, and I can just imagine who passed it. The DEP's refusal to address the overwhelming public consensus that we need to reject this and repeal 1853, start over with a statute to provide a legal framework for the protection of the health and economy of our area. In doing the opposite, ignoring 500 Mainers and interest parties and those that have petitioned, I've received over 1,000 people that are in favor of a moratorium for metallic mining and protect the waters of Maine. The basis statement is based on a misconception that the waters were already polluted in Maine, that the area already had arsenic contained in it that was of no consequence if it was contaminated. And this is not the case. We drink the water, we have been for 40 years, and my wife's been tested for arsenic and she doesn't have any in her. We eat the fish, we rely on that sustenance. Fish River watershed supports a wealth of people in the area, guides, fishermen, families come out when there's no other work to be had. They can still come out and get a meal. They can fish and they can hunt in the area. Carpon is home to heritage brook trout and salmon that are born and bred right in the streams in Carpon. Dr. Robert Seal, who actually did the initial water samples for the Bald Mountain studies, says these waters are not polluted, quote unquote. They are 100% natural part of the ecosystem. And as a fly fisherman, I can attest there are more black flies than anybody would ever want. This is home to a trophy trout and salmon and togue industry. Now, we're producing fish out there, hand over fish. I would specifically like to address that in the basis statement. We're talking about drinking water. The standards are all relying on drinking water standards. This isn't what a fish would live in. If you put a fish in your tap water, you'll watch how fast he dies. Now, this isn't the natural existing background that was in the 1991 rules. So these are Class A, Class AA waters, and they shouldn't be denigrated. I'm concerned these don't address the exploration and advanced exploration. I've witnessed firsthand what exploration can do. They drill a hole, they take a sample, they back flush the hole, and in the process, there's a lot of stuff that goes in the ground. And like fire, water doesn't stay where you put it. It has a tendency to move. So we witnessed the siltation of Carpon as these waters came back flushing down Moose Brook. We're 2 miles away. Allowing groundwater contamination in a mining area is a recipe for disaster. I worked in golf course incidents for 15 years, and I was a golf course superintendent, and I studied architect under Donald Ross. I know groundwater moves. So if you have contamination in a site, you're going to have contamination moving out throughout the groundwater. It's a fact that these chemicals, these minerals, especially metallic minerals, have a tendency to covalent bond and move throughout the water table. So it's not going to stay where you put it. There's a substantial flow. At some 1,000-foot elevation, Bald Mountain has a drop of 400 feet to Carr Pond. That's a lot of drop. There's a lot of water moving down through there. There's never been a flow study that's determined what's going through there. So before you can even consider where the water is going to end up, you have to do a lot more research as far as the hydrology in that area goes. There's two major faults going through that mountain. Well, where does the water go in those faults? I'm pretty sure I'm drinking it in my spring. That stream used to run logs 15 miles to Portage Lake. There was a mill in Portage Lake. So there's enough flow to move lumber down through the mud pond, through the fish lake, and down the fish river all the way to Portage. Now, I urge you to reject these rules, which confirm the statutory provision that allows for groundwater discharge, as it was never the public will. We were never allowed to comment on it. Your duty to the legislation is to reject this misguided rules on a twice rejected LD 750, and that only became law because of a clerical error. Speak out against it. It was basically gutted of all the content of any wealth, any worth, and basically used as a shell game to move this forward for the profit of the corporation. If you knew there was some way to not poison your downstream neighbors, would you? That's the question before you. Do the correct thing. Reject the notion that groundwaters can be controlled in a mining area. The contamination of AA and A waters is acceptable. And reject the basis statement. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Would you like my comments?
Good morning, Chairman Parker, members of the board. My name is Nick Bennett. I'm the staff scientist for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, and I reside in Hallwall. NRCM, Natural Resources Council of Maine, continues to strongly oppose these rules. I just want to quickly give you the reasons why. First, the simple ones. We oppose mining on public lands. We oppose mining underneath rivers, lakes, streams, coastal waters. That one seems to be something that's worth a little bit of explanation. One of the things about an underground mine is that only the part where you're taking out the ore is underground. There are huge surface facilities, even associated with a tiny mine like the Eagle Mine. That's tiny. It's like a tenth the size of the ore body at Bald Mountain. So how relevant that is in terms of the discussions we've been having about what kind of mines we expect to see in Maine, I don't know. But that's got a huge surface facility associated with it, with discharges next to a really good brook trout fishery. And so that mine had a lot of public opposition to it, and Michigan went ahead and permitted it. I don't know that they made the right move on that, but I think you can understand why many people who own lakefront property or riverfront property would be very scared about having a mine underneath their lake or their riverfront property, because the surface facility is going to be just like the surface facility at a open pit mine. There's going to be a lot of trucks. There's going to be big environmental impacts. There's going to be discharges to the water body, etc. So I don't think that it's reasonable to just think of a mine shaft under a lake. It's just a hole that's going to go under a lake. it's going to be a hole that goes under a lake, and you got to put the surface facility somewhere nearby that processes all that stuff. So think about the impacts of what that would be to water bodies like Cobbs Cook Bay, Moosehead Lake, any of our lakes. Lakes are a huge economic driver in Maine. They support more than 50,000 jobs. They supply over $3 billion in total economic impact to the state annually. Just that's the basis for our opposition for this, in addition to the risk of water quality contamination of these water bodies. So public lands, mining under water bodies, we continue to oppose those things. Next I'm going to go to financial assurance. I know what a worst case scenario is. I don't know what DEP's long paragraph that Mr. Crawford read to you today says. I think that if they want to have clear financial assurance language, they can do it. Here's the problem that we see with what these rules are likely to allow, and what the reason we are so persistent about the financial assurance issue. And that is because financial assurance is usually given in the amount of a few million bucks. It's something like 10, you look at mines that have been disasters, like the Summitville mine in Colorado or the Beal Mountain mine in Montana, both modern mines, started in the late 80s, both costing somewhere in the area of $200 to $500 million to clean up. The financial assurance that the companies put forward was about $6 to $10 million. That's just in the wrong order of magnitude. When you're dealing with these types of facilities, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars to clean up. The $6 to $10 million, the $20 million, that's in case sometimes these companies are more like wildcatters than they are big established mining firms, and they don't have a lot of money. And if they just go bankrupt because the price of metal goes down, then $10 million can help you put a site to bed if nothing horrible has gone wrong, or $20 million. That's a reasonable amount of money if what you're doing is talking about putting a small mine site to bed where there hasn't been a disaster. But that's not the big problem with mining. That's not where it ends up costing taxpayers huge amounts of money. Where it ends up costing taxpayers a huge amount of money is when a disaster happens. And they happen too often. And the disasters are not in the $20 million range. They're in the $200 million range or the $1 billion range. And they take decades to clean up. And it's not fair to make Maine people pay for that. And so we want a clear statement that mining companies have to put up enough money to pay for their disasters and to pay for potential disasters. That's not what we read in the language that Mr. Crawford said to you today. And we don't think it should be hard, if that's what DEP wants to do, to make that language clear. It still isn't. And we think it's very important that that determination of what the cost is and the amount of money that should go up front, whether it's in bonds or whether it's in cash or whatever, that needs to be done by a third party with some expertise in this issue, because the department hasn't done financial assurance calculations for mines. Nobody did this kind of stuff in the 1970s when we had mines here in Maine. And that's a long time ago. So we want that done by a third party. I don't think that's that complicated to do if that's what the department really wants to do. And so we get frustrated when, after 5 years of asking for this, because that's when it started, is 5 years ago, we still get what looks like gobbledygook to us about financial assurance. It should be clear. It should be understandable to the public that they're not going to have to pay for a potential mining disaster. That just seems fair to us. The other big issue that, well, there are two other big issues. One of those is the wet mine waste units. For the first time today, I heard Mr. Stebbins say a tailings impoundment is a wet mine waste unit. We've been asking again and again and again since 2012. Well, actually, I think they introduced wet mine waste units in 2013. So for 4 years, what's the difference between a wet mine waste unit and a tailings impoundment? And we've gotten no answer. So the answer is there is no difference, right? It's just a different waste stream. So a tailings impoundment is for handling the fine material that settles to the bottom of flotation tanks where you're trying to get the desired ore to the top so you can skim that off. And then there's a lot of fine junk that settles to the bottom, and you discharge that to an impoundment. That's a common procedure. And in cases where those tailings are acid generating, it's also a common procedure to cover them with water so that you lower the amount of acid generation, not eliminate it. And that's a dangerous situation because these tailings impoundments can be enormous. The dams have to last forever, and they fail. And in fact, 80% of tailings dam failures occur during the active life of the mine, not after the mine has closed, because that's when you're putting in more stuff, you're pumping in more tailings, and that's when the stresses on the dams are biggest. And the idea, okay, so you take a site like Bald Mountain, which, you know, is the one we've had as our center of discussion. It's about a 30 million ton ore body. A general rule of thumb, and it's just a general rule of thumb, 99% of what you've got in an ore body is waste. 1% of the stuff is what you're after. So you're starting there with 29 million tons of waste. Some of that's going to be tailings, some of that's going to be waste rock. That doesn't include the overburden, which doesn't count as the ore body, but that may still be acid generating, it may still leach heavy metals. So let's say roughly for a small to middling mine like Bald Mountain, you're probably dealing with about 100 million tons of stuff, roughly, just for the sake of argument. And maybe 40 million tons of that is tailings, and they're saying dry management for tailings, great. 60 million tons of it is other stuff. You're going to put that underwater, and then you're going to dig it up and put it somewhere else? That is just not comprehensible to me. And the idea that all of this is big boulders is preposterous, because how do you get waste rock out of a mine? You blast it. That means you get a lot of particulate matter in there. And so whatever acid-generating material is in the waste rock that you cover with water and put behind a dam is going to generate acid. It's going to leach metals. If that dam fails, it's not going to be a bunch of big boulders that stay in place. You'll have some boulders that stay in place. You'll also have a lot of fine material that moves downstream. You'll have a lot of acid and heavy metal contamination in the impoundment that would also move downstream. It's just not reasonable to think that once you have covered this stuff with water, you're going to dig it up. And in point of fact, while covering water to limit acid generation is indeed a common mining practice, it's a really dangerous one. It does limit acid generation. There's no question about that, but it greatly increases the risk of a physical structural failure. And that that's a big concern. And I just want to read very quickly. This is from a publication on that was the Proceedings on Tailings and Mine Waste in 2011 in British Columbia. It's a paper that came out of that conference called Mine Waste Management in Wet Mountainous Terrain, Some British Columbia Perspectives. And I give you this paper, but instead I'm just going to read. So here's what a quote from this paper says about managing tailings impoundments or waste rock impoundments. The principles of sustainability mandate that we consider fully today and in the future the nature of that bequest, how best to manage it, and how it is likely to come to be viewed and managed by future generations. The bequest is these tailings impoundments. For there is never an inopportune moment to step back and contemplate what we are doing today and planning for tomorrow. In BC, provincial guidelines observe that for subaqueous disposal to effectively prevent acid rock drainage over the long term, the storage location must remain permanently flooded and geotechnically stable. Okay? These are permanent facilities. the idea that a mining company is going to have 40 million tons of waste rock under a 100-acre pond and then dig it all up and ship it to a hazardous waste site in New York by train or some other way, that's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And I think you should strongly continue to question DEP on why they think that it's reasonable to allow wet mine waste units during the life of the mine, but not afterwards. Because if you allow a wet mine waste unit during the life of the mine, you're going to have it forever. And there should just be some truth in advertising here. Finally, we have tried and have asked the board to address the issue of groundwater contamination. That's really what this whole issue is about, is how much groundwater contamination do you allow for a mine? And J.D. Irving and the proponents of the 2012 law came in and said, well, we've got a complete ban on groundwater contamination in Maine in the 1991 rules, and that equates to a complete ban on mining. So what are we going to do? We're going to allow infinite amounts of groundwater contamination in the mining area. There is something in between that that might lower between zero and infinite, that might lower the risks of contamination spreading to our surface waters. I would just urge you to consider recommending that the legislature think about that, because going from zero to infinite is not necessary. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for that? Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak.
We have one more. Ron Huber.
All right. Well, hello, Chairman Parker and the rest of the board and people here. I'm Executive Director of Friends of Penobscot Bay. Since 1992, I've been studying Maine's biggest bay and its users and advocated for actions by government against actions by governments and by industry at the same time. Does it conserve or is it going to threaten the health of Penobscot Bay? Now, I'm here to speak on behalf of our members and supporters, basically in opposition to these proposed major substantive mining rules. And one of the things that really concerned folks was the removing the prohibition from mining under coastal wetlands. And the reasons that we heard, the rationalizations, I don't think they were very good for that, because, as you know, Penobscot Bay is host to this long-defunct, still toxic, exuding Callahan mine site. And one of the things coming out, mercury, of course, which Penobscot Bay's lobster fishery is harmed enough by the things coming down the river from Orrington, this is another addition. Now, you know, it simply shows that mining in coastal waters don't mix well. Mining under coastal waters, no matter how well-intentioned, you're really risking our seafood industries. They're way more important, I think, for Maine people than what mining would bring to a relatively smaller number. And also wanted to agree with the fact of the very short notice. It's terrifying to be able to have someone say, quick, read these and give us your thoughts. And so I really think that, indeed, when someone pointed out that the public notice was insufficient under FOIA and public meetings law, that they were correct. And certainly the basis statement flaws have been outlined in great, great detail, and I don't want to take up your time other than ask you really, really take heed of everything you've heard already from folks and take heed of those responses you got from people. It was very, very erudite, very concerned, a lot of information, and as people here are saying, they feel it's been largely ignored, or the review of the comments has been inadequate. So I think the proposal that I've been hearing more and more here to simply either reject the entire thing or notify the legislature that they've got to do better, that you can only make a rule as good as a law, and if the law isn't good, your rules aren't going to be much better. And I think that's it, so thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, that concludes those who signed up to testify. We're going to take a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back.